Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ongoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. So joining me today is Alan Hirsch, author of The Role of SOEs in Development in South Africa, in the much acclaimed book, Better Choices for South Africa. This conversation is part of our series highlighting key events from the book. Alan Hirsch is a man with an incredible legacy of service and leadership. He has been director of the Graduate School of Development Policy and Practice at UCT. He's managed economic policy in the South African presidency, represented the presidency at the G20, and was co-chair of the G20 Development Working Group. He served and actually serves on several boards, and of course, he's authored many articles and a book on economic policy reform in South Africa. Today, he's gracing us on the show and granting me his time about his chapter contribution to the book, Better Choices. Alan, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Marie Noel, and thank you for your kind introduction.
Oh, my pleasure. All right. So in the book, Better Choices, you authored a chapter, The Role of SOEs in Development in South Africa, which is important for plugging somewhat of a knowledge gap on SA state-owned enterprises and their usefulness today, if I can call it that. But before we get into it, I wanted to ask, Alan, what would you say was your biggest aha moment and takeaway from putting together this chapter?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I came at this chapter as an academic, as somebody who's done a lot of research on political economy of South Africa, but also as a former member of several boards of state-owned enterprises. So I was on the board of the Industrial Development Corporation, on the board of Denel, the Denel Corporation, and on the board of the subsidiary. I was the chair of the board of Denel Aviation. So I came into this with some experience, and what struck me really when I started to investigate this, and it isn't the central area of my research, I did a lot of new reading, was that the government initiative to resolve problems in state-owned enterprises, which had, I don't know if it still does, but for a long time there was a lot of talk about the centralization of control over state-owned enterprises through a commission. And then there was talk within that commission, the Commission on State-Owned Enterprises, of the need to establish a single state holding company which would effectively control the companies. I thought that that was going down the wrong road, that it was making a very complex situation even more complex, and it wasn't going to solve the problem. So I was, you know, quite disturbed, I guess, when I saw that was seen as a solution to the problem. I don't think it is.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a very good observation to make. And hopefully we sort of talk about some of these things as we get into the chapter. So let's start here, right? So SOEs, we know, are often sort of positioned as developmental tools. Can you share a bit about, you know, this logic and whether it's proven to be true, especially in modern South Africa today?
Well, I think in every country there have been some successful SOEs, some that are less successful. So, I mean, I'm currently in the UK. The National Health Service in the UK is an extraordinarily successful SOE. The BBC in the UK is extraordinarily successful. In South Africa, there've been terrific SOEs. For a long time, Eskom was seen as a global leader in development and distribution of electrical services. The airports company of South Africa, which was actually only formed under the new government, was very well led by its first chief executive, and was very successful in developing airports and prepared them very well for the 2010 World Cup. SANRAL, which got into a lot of trouble, it's the roads company in South Africa, got into a lot of trouble over the Gauteng toll system. But up to that point, and even since then, SANRAL has been a very efficient organization at building good national roads and even helping provinces build good and maintain good national roads, or provincial roads. So, you know, there's no question that there are some places where the state can play a developmental role as effectively or more effectively than the private sector could.
Yeah. So I think that's quite an interesting segue, I guess, to what I want to ask next is SA's SOEs are in trouble, somewhat of trouble today. How did SOE governance go from being portrayed as a model, right, for emulation in, I think it was the World Bank's 2005 or 6 report on SOEs globally to what they are today? Can we sort of pinpoint when the decay started and how it's been allowed to continue in that fashion for the last, you know, decade or two?
Well, firstly, you know, even though the World Bank said South Africa was a model of SOE governance, it may not have been the best model. They did say it was a very good model, and they did compare it favorably with many others. And I think, I mean, that was the time at which I was on a couple of boards, and I do think that it was a good experience for me, because essentially what happened was that the then Minister of Public Enterprises arranged for the appointment of very good boards, and I was happy. I was actually a government representative, and I wouldn't mind saying more about them that question later, because I do think there's no reason why there shouldn't be government representatives on boards. But alongside me, there were experienced executives from private and public companies in South Africa and globally. And there were people with tremendous experience in different fields. So there were finance people, there were legal people, there were human resources people on the board. And we had the kind of expertise that, you know, added a lot of value to the organization. And the chair, who was at that point, he was the president of the CSIR, was a wonderful chair. And he led a process of restructuring of Denel that I thought was very successful. So at that time, the board was allowed, I mean, under the supervision of ministers, and the ministers were always very interested in what was happening, but they didn't interfere significantly. And the strategy that was adopted at that time by Denel, for example, was quite a revolutionary one. It was saying, we're going to divide Denel into a series of subsidiaries and find strategic partners in international companies to buy major shareholdings in those companies. And then we managed to basically strengthen those organizations. What happened after that was that politicians got more and more involved in the day-to-day workings of organizations. Essentially, the job of the minister is to appoint the board. And then the job of the board is to appoint the chief executive and to approve and to contribute to and to approve a strategic direction for the organization. Then the chief executive and his executive or her executive goes ahead and implements that strategy. And the board oversees it. And when things are going wrong, the board gets involved. And at other times, the board just approves and allows for the continuation of the process. What was happening in the late 2009s, really after Polokwane, Congress of the ANC, the focus of the organization shifted towards SOEs playing a much bigger role in a much broader process. They defined it in political terms or developmental terms at that meeting, but it became more than that. So ministers got very involved, and suddenly, you know, what happened with the Denel board, just as an example, on it, about 3/4 of the board was suddenly dismissed, including myself, with a nice letter from the minister concerned, Minister Gigaba, and new people were appointed. they appointed a new board, and that new board, the new minister appointed a new board, and they appointed a new chief executive, and the new chief executive changed the executive quite considerably, and there was much more political interference as things went on. So,
yeah,
for various reasons. I mean, I think that it was partly ideological reasons, that they believed, ministers believed, that they were implementing the policies that were decided by the ANC at Polokwane, and they could therefore had a right to get involved, and that there were things that the organizations were not doing right. But I mean, this also became a mask for corruption in many of those organizations,
right,
where the chief executives who were appointed were people who would be pliant and would feed into the corrupt strategies of people outside of the organization, often facilitated by politicians.
That's interesting. So, and earlier, actually, you had just mentioned that you still think, or you do think, it's important to have, is it government representation on boards? Now, this is obviously different, I think, but if we think about the kinds of people that I guess get appointed, how do you imagine, or I guess, why do you think it's still necessary to have government representation on boards, especially in a context like this?
Well, you know, this is I've actually discussed this with corporate governance people, corporate governance experts, the people who wrote the code of conduct for private sector corporate governance in South Africa, Michael Katz, the lawyer, and others. And, you know, I put it to them that it's better to have a somebody who is representative of government. At that point, I was in the president's office, sitting on the board, who's able to represent the views of the government as one of the members of the board, but yeah, not as somebody who has a veto or has any kind of control over the board. I wasn't the chair of the board, and I was in a small minority. So I could indicate what I thought the views of my principals were. But that didn't mean that the policies that were implemented necessarily were exactly the same as what I said. In fact, they probably weren't. And I think that it's good to have that kind of a link, so that it's much better to have that than to have external political interference in a board. So you have one member of a board who says, well, this is what the government says, this is what cabinet said at the last meeting, and you know, this is what I think the intention of it was, and then the board can ponder it and make their own decision. It's much better to have that sort of situation than to have a situation where if the board makes a decision that the government doesn't like, they just change the board and then you know, change the executive. So I think that's the choice. I do think that there should be, you know, the government is the shareholder on behalf of the people of the country. The shareholder should have a representative on the board, but that shareholder shouldn't control the board.
Shouldn't control the board. How do we manage that in a context where a lot of the times the even appointments to the boards are political? Or is this an attempt to try to get around that to some extent?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends what you mean by political. If you look at the appointment of the recent new board for Eskom, I think it's an expert board. I know many of the people on the board, and I know others by reputation, and I think that they were chosen because they are experts in their fields, you know, including competent technology, law, finance, and others, but also because they understand what the developmental intentions of the government are. So, you know, political with a big P, in the sense of, you know, people being appointed because they are members of a political organization or because they are subservient to a political organization, that would be very problematic. Or because they, but political with a small p, and people who understand what the broad intention of the government is, and within their own, you know, and they have a fiduciary responsibility towards the company in the first place. They have to take that responsibility, that legal responsibility, very, very seriously. But within that, to be able to understand what the broad intentions of the government are, I don't see that as a problem. As true in any country as it is in South Africa.
Yeah. So I think part of, you know, understanding the role of SOEs as well, if South Africa's SOEs are in trouble, then we should be fixing them. So I guess my question is, can they be fixed and what does it look like to fix them? Now, I imagine obviously that would probably differ depending on the SOE. So I'm happy to talk about a specific one. So I'm curious to hear from your research and the insights that you have, what would fixing South Africa's SOEs look like and require?
So I think the first thing is, if I were in government at the moment, one of the things that I would be doing, and it is an exercise that I did many years ago when I was in government, is to actually look at all the SOEs and decide which of them is actually needed, which of them isn't needed at all, because there are many, and this includes a number of agencies and various types of organizations. Some of them are just redundant. They continue to exist just because there's a fear that ending them would upset people who are employed by them or have posts, you know, some sort of honorary posts in them. And I think that there needs to be some quite, not heartless, but still tough evaluation of what is needed and what isn't needed, and which can be merged and which can be dispensed with altogether, and which can perhaps be sold to the private sector. So I think there should be a rationalization of the SOE system.
Yeah.
And in some SOEs, that means, you know, within the SOE, some activities should remain within the SOE and others should be privatized. So, for example, in the case of Transnet, Transnet is moving towards concessioning service provision on some of its rail lines. The idea of Transnet moving towards an organization which is responsible for the system, but not necessarily responsible for all of the services, is a good idea. Instead of having to take responsibility for everything, and you could have a range of services. You could have services that work with the mines, getting the mine ores to the port. You can have services that work with the fruit companies, getting the fruit to the other ports and refrigerated containers and so on. You can have passenger carriers and general freight carriers and so on. I think that there are ways of restructuring. So how do you do that?
Yeah.
I don't think you do that by centralizing everything around one board in government. I think you do that by actually simplifying the mandates of those institutions and trying to reduce the number of institutions involved in the decision making. So try to make sure that there's one minister that is involved and responsible for appointing the board, and that board operates as the board of an organization which understands the broad role of the company, is well equipped and is well equipped to restructure the company to achieve those objectives, rather than having a series of governance institutions, layers of governance institutions. Sometimes they're two ministers. So in the case of Transnet, is it the Minister of Transport or the Minister of Enterprises who's responsible? That has to be clear. Sometimes there are regulators involved. In the electricity case, there's NERSA. In the transport case, there are a number of regulators. Their roles have to be clear, and they have to be executed in such a way that they don't interfere, you know, in a bad way with the cleaning up of these organizations. I think the key thing is to appoint a good board and for the minister to allow that good board to take action, you know, within broad government policy and not to get directly involved and not to get too involved. I think that recent developments around SAA, and, you know, I predicted that implicitly in my article, I said, you know, who knows what's going to happen to SAA. That was probably, I finished drafting it about a year and a half ago, or at least a year ago. A year later, we still don't know what's going to happen to SAA. There was going to be a new company which took it over. One of the key directors has just resigned because he doesn't believe that the process is transparent, and it's a process which is managed in some way within government. I don't know exactly where it's managed. I haven't studied it very carefully, but clearly it's not a process where the directors are taking responsibility for the actions and making the organization work. So yeah, I think you need to simplify the mandate structures, make sure that there's not too much complexity in the governance of those institutions, and appoint really good boards and encourage them to take action. Now, in some cases, you know, boards, companies are in really bad financial trouble, and they have to be bailed out because they are providing essential services such as Eskom. So government taking over some of Eskom's debt, as they probably will do in the next budget, is not a bad idea. It's something that will allow Eskom to do its job better. But that job in the future will include some significant rationalization of Eskom. I could go into detail, but you probably may have gone into that with Ray.
we did quite a bit of a deep dive in Eskom. But Alan, one question I wanted to make sure I asked before you leave is, so you even mentioned when you were sort of responding to this that you sort of made these recommendations before when you were in government. Can you speak a little bit about what is required to ensure that, you know, we set the ball rolling in this manner, or that some of these decisions are actually made, especially if, you know, people like you have been saying it for a while, you've had a chance to be in some of these spaces. Is there something we are missing? Is it just that it needs to be said more times, or what needs to be done to allow these possible successes and ability to turn these around for good or better, I guess?
You know, ultimately, it's decisions that are made by ministers and the cabinet and the president. And we have quite a number of advisory institutions to the president. We have, you know, I'm on the president's Economic Advisory Council, along with several other of the authors of the Better Choices book. Mm-hmm. There are several other. There is an advisory council on state-owned enterprises, and there are several others. And we have the opportunity to put our position to president. We have an opportunity to put our position to ministers. We have engaged with the president and ministers on those issues. And on many of those issues, you know, many of the issues that we've raised, there's been a lot of response. I think that quite a lot of the reform in the electricity sector was stuff which was put forward in the president's Economic Advisory Council. It may have been put forward elsewhere as well, but it's, you know, very good reforms and does show that the government was listening. You know, I think that those channels need to be kept open and those conversations need to continue. And that forums like the forum that you're offering, and forums maybe between civil society and government and business and government and trade unions and government, need to be kept open so that these conversations happen.
No, definitely. I couldn't agree more. Well, Alan, thank you. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with us about this. I really hope that even as people listen, they're encouraged to pick up the book, because the insights in here are incredibly practical as much as they are sort of intellectually inspiring, if I can call it that. So again, thank you for the time, and hopefully I'll see you in person sometime soon.
I hope so, Marie Noel.
All right. Thank you, Alan.
Okay. Thank you.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast. And it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.